Why are we so terrified about abandonment?
I do think that it goes back to, you know, that story from our childhood comes from a place of total dependency on other people. You know, only as children are we completely dependent on other people. And I think sometimes when that old script or those old feelings get triggered, a part of our consciousness sort of regresses to childhood and seeks to completely yield to our adult relationship as if we're a child, sort of giving over our power as we had to as children. You know, someone actually said to me in the midst of the experience of that affair, I was like, I'm just so afraid she's going to abandon me. And this friend of mine was like, you're an adult. You cannot be abandoned.
That's Melissa Phoebos. We talk with her about her acclaimed new memoir, Abandon Me. And the Republicans want to slash or even end the payroll tax for Social Security. They're billing it as a middle-class tax cut. But
that would make it much, much easier to cut benefits down the line. So I think it's very dangerous. It's a terrible idea. It really puts Social Security at the mercy of short-term politics all the time. And it's really not something you want to do.
That's business journalist Michael Hiltzik. We talk with him about the Republican attack on Social Security. We also call up Nancy Altman of Social Security Works to talk about Trump's attack on Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Abandon is a funny word. It has two meanings. As a verb, it means to cease to support or look after someone, or to give something up. As a noun, it means a complete lack of inhibition or restraint. Melissa Phoebos's new memoir, Abandon Me, brings together essays that revolve around these two themes, sometimes in their separate meanings, sometimes intertwined. It explores her fear of abandonment, first experienced in her childhood, with a birth father who left her early on, and a beloved stepfather, a sea captain, who was always going off to sea. That early fear is reignited when Phoebos abandons herself to a torrid love affair with a woman who has, let's just say, commitment issues. She also revisits some former abandonments she wrote about in a previous memoir, abandonments to drug addiction and to the extremes of sexual expression as a dominatrix. Melissa Phoebos' first memoir was the critically acclaimed Whip Smart. Abandon Me was published by Bloomsbury Press earlier this year. Well, Melissa Phoebos, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Abandon Me. It's almost like a command.
Yeah, that was a conscious choice on my part. And I think, you know, I thought of the title of the book before I wrote most of it. And I think sort of inherent in that is this wish to be able to look back at the experiences that I was writing about in the book and to claim them and to sort of be grateful for that experience. You know, so much of the experience of living through those events was so painful and so harrowing and felt like something that was happening to me. And I think I wanted to write towards this idea of the other definition of the word abandon, you know, rather than being abandoned, to abandon yourself to something, you know? So I think to put it in the imperative in that way, abandon me, seemed to sort of claim the experience, like, yes, it was worth it, you know, even though it hurt.
Yes, and when you say abandon me, I mean, of course, there can be the great pleasure of abandoning oneself to experience, but very much in this book, one gets a sense that early patterns of abandonment dictated in some way a drive to be abandoned and to abandon oneself to somebody else. I wonder if you could talk about that connection.
Sure, yeah. I mean, a lot of the book is sort of predicated on that relationship. And, you know, one of the main sort of narrative threads of it is this very obsessive, very intense love affair that I had. And at some point in the midst of that love affair, I was crying every single day. You know, it really just hijacked my whole consciousness and indeed my whole life. And I had this awareness that the actual situation that was happening didn't warrant the intensity of my response to it. And I remember I was having this conversation with my mother on the phone and sort of talking to her about it a little bit. And she said to me, you know, when you were a kid and your father, and my father was a sea captain, was always leaving, you know, when you were very small, you would get so upset and hysterical and cry. And then at a certain point, you just stopped and you no longer grieved his leaving. And some light bulb went off in my mind during that conversation. And I thought, oh, this is that. I have imported or released some grief from my childhood that I'm now sort of reenacting through this relationship that I'm having. And, you know, that's a very reductive point of view, but I don't think it's untrue. And, you know, that becomes sort of the hypothesis of much of the book, that sort of the unresolved wounds of our childhood are the compasses that drive our choices in relationships, you know, and sort of only by reliving them on some level, reconstructing and reliving them, can we find redemption and heal in some way.
We keep on looking for another ending, a different ending.
Exactly. And, I think it's a cliche in our culture, too, that people are always sort of dating their parents. You know, we're always looking for those sort of familiar archetypes from our childhood. And I think that that's a cliche because it's often true.
Yeah, I don't know whether it's because it is just a common human condition or whether it's a history of abandonment that I sense in my own self, but also one that came down through generations of my family. But it felt very familiar to me, this idea that once in love, I would abandon myself to somebody else. And what is it about being abandoned as a child, that early wound that drives one to give up oneself in other relationships?
I mean, I wish that I had a perfect answer to that. I don't. But I do think that it goes back to, you know, that story from our childhood comes from a place of total dependency on other people. You know, only as children are we completely dependent on other people. And I think sometimes when that old script or those old feelings get triggered, a part of our consciousness sort of regresses to childhood and seeks to completely yield to our adult relationship as if we're a child, sort of giving over our power as we had to as children, you know, even though, you know, someone actually said to me in the midst of the experience of that affair, I was like, I'm just so afraid she's going to abandon me. And this friend of mine was like, you're an adult. You cannot be abandoned. Like, that's actually not a thing that can happen to an adult in the way that you mean, you know, like your life will not be in danger if this person leaves you, you know, it only feels that way because you are sort of half existing in your own child self when that was true. But as an adult, it's never true. It's just, it's this sort of emotional projection.
We are talking with Melissa Phoebos. Her book is Abandon Me, Memoirs. Now, I made a reference just before to an intergenerational pattern. You link this not only to your own family, and I'd like you to talk about that, but also to the historical group to which your family, your fathers belonged to. There was a Native American element in both of them. Your stepfather was a Puerto Rican and your biological father was from the Wampanoag tribe. So talk about this whole sense of abandonment and trauma as it is transmitted through the generations.
You know, I didn't intend to have that be an element of this book when I started writing it, and I really sort of explored my way into it. And I think, you know, at a certain point, it became difficult for me not to see an analogy between the kind of historical erasure that is the legacy of colonialism, and then how it sort of existed in my own personal life. And by that I mean, you know, I had this birth father who I never knew, and I effectively was never really curious about. I just made a decision when I was young, like, I don't understand what that connection means, so I'm just not going to be interested in it. I'm not going to think about it. I'm not curious about it. I don't want to look at it. And so effectively tried to sort of erase something that I was biologically connected to. And it wasn't until I was 32 and I decided to go look for him that I really sort of turned toward the fact of that biological connection and realized that it did mean something to me. I hadn't erased the connection just by refusing to look at it, you know? And then when I started looking into my family history, I found, you know, I found this census where my great-grandfather had lied about his ethnicity and said that he was Polish instead of Native. And I couldn't help but see this sort of legacy of erasure that got handed down. And then in a much larger sort of national way, you know, we celebrate Thanksgiving. And, you know, I don't ever remember really learning about the genocide of the tribe that I descend from, even though I grew up in a place where the descendants lived, you know? So it was this sort of much larger scale erasure of something that happened. But that refusal to look at that aspect of our history doesn't erase those people. It doesn't erase the atrocities that were committed against them. And in fact, it's sort of an illness of our culture that we choose to look away from certain ugly parts of our history, which perpetuates their trauma. And I think that in all families, this is an element, right? We don't invent ourselves. We get handed down sort of a set of dynamics and beliefs and mythology about where we come from. And I do believe we have agency to change that or correct it or redefine it for ourselves, but we're always operating on some level in reaction to it. You know, both my parents have family histories that involve, you know, erasure and addiction and, you know, attachment issues that have occurred in my own life. Even though they gave me a very different, much happier childhood than either of them had, I still descend from their experience, and there's really no getting around that.
And when you did find your father, did you rediscover a part of yourself that you had abandoned?
I did. And, you know, even more so, I think, you know, it almost gave me permission to claim certain parts of my identity that had frightened me before that. You know, I'm an addict, an alcoholic in recovery, and I have been for almost 14 years. But I have always remembered being a child and exhibiting these sort of behaviors that are consistent with addicts and alcoholics. Like, I do think there's a very strong biological component, but neither of the parents who raised me or anyone in my immediate family has any of that. And so I always sort of felt like I was alone in it and something was maybe wrong with me, or, you know, they had given me a happy childhood. Why did I seek out these extremes? And then when I went and met my birth father, I immediately recognized those sort of darker aspects of my personality. And I felt so much compassion for him and for the other family members that I met, which really sort of allowed me to both accept and have a kind of tenderness for those parts of myself, because they weren't broken, you know, they were my biological legacy, and I'd found a way to recover from them and even to sort of sublimate them by becoming an artist or whatever. And so it felt like sort of placing this piece of me in with all the others, or a kind of integration that I hadn't been capable of before I went and found them.
So, Melissa Phoebos, you were an alcoholic. You also became addicted to heroin. And your first memoir was about being a dominatrix. I'm not sure what I'm reaching for here, but I have a sense that these things are connected.
Yeah, I agree. And it's, you know, in many ways, that material from my first book sort of made its way into this book, and I kind of tried to keep it out for a while, and then I decided to just let it in because it seemed pretty unarguable that they were connected. And I think that, you know, my experience as a dominatrix, I had this sort of narrative about it when I began and while I was doing it and for a little while afterwards, that I had just been sort of brave and curious and was sort of a hack anthropologist and otherwise not different from anyone else. And after I wrote that book, I really came to a much more complex understanding of my own desire to sort of push boundaries and as a way of trying to figure out who exactly I was and where my limits were. Because a big part of sort of the job of the dominatrix is to play out these different roles, you know, and enact sort of different iconic female stereotypes. And I think I understood even then that there were parts of me that I didn't know how to claim and that I didn't know where they came from. And they didn't really match up with kind of the prescriptions for femininity or sexuality that we're all sort of socialized in American culture. And so I sort of understood that I needed to maybe look elsewhere, you know, and being a dominatrix, one of the ways that I frame it is as a search for that, sort of looking for a way to contextualize or understand or define those darker parts of my personality. And I think that also they were about negotiating power in relationships, you know, and sort of trying to figure out how much control I could have, how much control I wanted to have. And so much of this new book is about sort of power in relationships. And, you know, it's really the story in many ways of the relationship where I finally felt disempowered. You know, every relationship up until the one that I described in the book, I felt on some really fundamental level that I held the reins of the relationship. And in this one, that wasn't the case. You know, and I think sometimes that when I was a dominatrix, I was enacting these roles of being in control, and I wanted to be empowered and in control, but in some deeper way, I think I was pushing for the boundary because I was sort of terrified by my own ability to manipulate and take control of my own life and my own situations, and I sort of wanted to find the limits of that, you know. And in Abandon Me, I found them. Right? I sort of found the place where I could no longer control how I felt or what other people did. And it was devastating and ultimately revelatory.
Revelatory?
Yeah. I mean, I think being out of control was the thing I had most feared. I thought it would be terrible and so painful, and it was. There are a few things that I have feared in my life that turned out to be as bad as I feared, and this really was so painful. But there is something incredibly powerful about living your worst fear, you know, and not dying of it. And that happened. And so in maybe the most basic way, I understood that the thing I most feared could happen, and I could be okay. And in, you know, in another way, I think that my desire to always be in control of my relationships really put sort of a lower ceiling on the possibilities for love in my life and on the possibilities of self-knowledge, because I wasn't willing to be vulnerable on a certain level or risk very much. And after I sort of went all the way to the other end of the spectrum, you know, I feel like it really sort of blew the roof off of the possibilities for me. And ironically, I feel like I'm willing to risk more. And my ideal is no longer to be completely in control, but to find something in the middle there where I am vulnerable, where something is being risked, but where no one has all the power, where it's more of a shared power and a collaboration. And I learned that from the experience, from that terribly harrowing experience of love.
Right. And in many ways, it's really not it's not the kind of relationship that the one that you described that you now feel more ready for is not the kind of relationship that's really actually even supported or modeled in our culture. I mean, our culture is so modeled on a sense of, you know, it's got to be one up and one down.
Exactly. And I think there's so, I mean, this is a the result of many cultural legacies, but also just capitalism and consumerism and love as a product that is sold to us incessantly in this highly romanticized, being swept off your feet idea of love, which is actually, I think, really juvenile and unsustainable. You know, like, there is a period of romanticism and falling in love, but that is not what long-standing relationships or real intimacy is made of, in my experience. And so I think, you know, Abandon Me is also a portrait of me sort of chasing that unrealistic form of love where it's grand gestures and tragic and incredibly intense all the time in some way or another, and sort of trying to sustain that for 2 years, and then inevitably having to sort of let go of that mythology in favor of an ideal that is more true to who I am, and that leaves more room for the beloved to be themselves instead of the screen onto which we project our own narratives or our childhood redemption stories or, you know, our fantasies.
We're talking with Melissa Phoebos about her second memoir. It's called Abandon Me. Melissa, your lover, Amaya, I mean, she was a quite a manipulative person herself. You talked before that you had before been in the position of being the one who held the reins. She's kind of a classic approach avoidance, you know, that's her MO. So this was a very difficult relationship. You stayed in despite the manipulations. You say that you were doing that because there was something there that you needed. And I wonder if she presented a kind of mirror to you in some way that helped you confront the dark parts of yourself.
Yeah, I think that she did. And, you know, I think that sort of the power structure in a relationship like that is something of an illusion. You know, I think that she was probably just as fearful, just as vulnerable, just as wounded as I was, but we were sort of caught in this dance where she would withdraw and I would lose my mind and pursue. But I experienced, you know, and I describe this near the end of the book, when I finally sort of exhausted that dynamic for myself and I started to withdraw, it just simply reversed and we were in the same pattern sort of going in the other direction. You know, it was like very, very hard to end a relationship like that because both of us were sort of desperate and attached in this very regressed sort of childlike way, you know? I think we were just sort of playing different roles at different points. And I think also when we have these fantasies of other people that we're projecting onto them, it's always sort of something that we're looking for in ourselves, you know? The things that we most desperately want from our lovers in relationships like that are, I think, always things that we can only give to ourselves. Like, only can we find that kind of security by becoming it ourselves, you know, by becoming a home for ourselves. Like, I'd so desperately wanted her to be always available to me and totally accepting of me and totally adoring of me, and saw her as this very sort of powerful, strong, sort of sometimes comforting force in my life. And by the end, you know, I really sort of understood that she could never give that to me or be that for me. She was just another human who was in pain, you know, and the kind of comfort and security that I sought, I had to become that for myself. I had to learn to give that to myself. And I think that people who are wise about relationships have almost always come to this understanding that we can only give that to ourselves. And also, it's once we have given that to ourselves and learned to become that for ourselves, only then are we really capable of loving in a generous way with another person. You know, only then do we become capable of really engaging and seeing another person in love.
Yeah, you say at one point that we who fear abandonment are often the most the most capable of leaving. So I think in a way that's what you're saying there. As long as you're so afraid of that, it's hard for you to sustain the kind of relationship that can really nourish you as well as the other person.
Yeah, exactly.
So how long did it take you? I mean, was this like an instantaneous process? You broke up with her and then you realized these things and went on? Or how did that happen?
No. You know, it's interesting because I actually wrote a lot of this book while I was still in the relationship. The early essays of the book, many of them I wrote while I was still in the relationship. And I began the long title essay. More than half the book is one long title essay. And I began that essay while I was still in it, and I had to stop halfway through so that I could continue living it. And then after we broke up, I finished writing the book, and then I gave it to a few friends of mine who had really understood what had happened, who had sort of observed me through the process of it, of living it. And you know, I thought I was done. And then I talked to these readers and both of them said the same thing. You know, my one very blunt friend said, this is a lovely story, but this is fiction. This is not what happened. This is the story that you were telling yourself while it was happening. This is a version of the story that she would be okay with that still sort of is loyal to your fantasy of the relationship, the story you held on to so that you could try to stay inside of it. And I was devastated because I had thought I was done, and I was not done. But I knew that she was right. I knew that I had to sort of smash that last layer of mythology or romanticization of our love affair and really tell the truth and put in the manipulation and, you know, my own sort of desperation and ways that I felt I'd humiliated myself and collaborated with her in this very sort of sick behavior. But once I realized that, it was some of the fastest writing I ever did. I went back and I rewrote the entire title essay, and really I just put in the parts that I had left out. I put in the interactions that really sort of distilled our dynamic, that power dynamic, and really showed the ways that we had projected onto each other, particularly that I had projected onto her. And it was really in the writing there that I started to be able to really name what I thought had happened and what I understood about how it spoke to sort of a larger, more universal idea of what we do in relationships, and particularly in relationships like that. You know, like I really, really sort of scrutinized my own accountability in that final draft.
Well, it's a very true book and a very profound one. Abandon Me by my guest, Melissa Phoebos. Thank you so much for talking with us here.
Thank you so much, Francesca.
Melissa Phoebos is the author of the memoir, Whip Smart. Abandon Me was published by Bloomsbury Press in February of 2017. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt. Next up, the attack on Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Ever since the Social Security Act was passed in 1935, Republicans have been trying to get rid of it. Ditto with Medicare, which was passed in 1965. But the enormous popularity of Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid have until now made these programs a so-called third rail of American politics. That could be changing. Not their popularity. That remains as high as ever. But the determination to gut those programs has gathered steam as the Republicans have captured all three branches of government. And their attack on Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid is happening under the radar. We talk first with LA Times columnist and author Michael Hiltzik about Trump's proposal to eliminate the Social Security payroll tax. In a column about it for the LA Times, Hiltzik called it Trump's worst idea yet. So you wrote a piece for the Los Angeles Times. You say that the Trump administration is toying with the idea of eliminating the payroll tax. What does the payroll tax do in terms of Social Security and Medicare?
So the payroll tax is really the major source of funding for Social Security and a significant source of funding for Medicare, part of Medicare. At this point, probably something in the neighborhood of, I'd say, 90% of Social Security's funding comes from the money that we put in. Employees put in 6.2% of their earnings with every paycheck. Employers contribute the same percentage. So that 12.4% really is what funds Social Security.
In this article, Michael Hiltzik, you talk a little bit about the history of how this kind of funding came about. What was the choice in the beginning in 1935 when Social Security was first enacted?
Well, there were two choices. One was to create a system that was funded entirely from general taxation, from the federal budget. That was known as a non-contributory plan. And then the other possibility was what they chose, which was to have workers and their employers to contribute along the way, that is, during an entire worker's entire career. And there were pluses and minuses to both. But in their wisdom, I think they chose probably the better way to fund Social Security.
And why was it the better way?
Well, there were a number of drawbacks to funding a program like this from general revenues. One was both that politicians, that is, members of Congress and presidents, could be inclined to expand Social Security too much, to add more and more benefits to it because they wouldn't see, nobody would really detect the cost because it would be buried in the federal budget. At the same time, they might also be inclined to cut it too much because Social Security would look like just another government program, and if budgets got tight and Congress started looking for ways to cut the budget, there would be no reason to avoid cutting Social Security any more or less than the national parks or housing assistance or even defense. So it was a way to tie, making it a contributory system was a way to tie it directly to what people would see in their paychecks. They would, first of all, workers would appreciate that they were paying for a program, and they would have a feeling of ownership of it, which is the case, I think, even today. And at the same time, there would be sort of a speed governor on how far it could be expanded or even how much it could be cut, for the same reason that workers would see the costs of the program in their paychecks every week or every 2 weeks, and at the same time they would feel that this program was theirs and they had paid for it.
Right. I mean, isn't it been called social insurance, and people pay into it in order to be covered at a time that they need it, just like any other insurance?
Yeah, social insurance, I think, is a bit of a broader label. Social insurance covers not only Social Security, but also Medicare and Medicaid, and it also covers the disability insurance aspect of Social Security, which pays workers who are disabled and can no longer work, and they can get those benefits long before they reach the age of 65 or 66.
But if they do cut the payroll tax, I mean, that also funds Medicare. A portion of it funds Medicare, so wouldn't that also have an impact on Medicare?
Yes, it would. I think the understanding is that if they were to eliminate the payroll tax, they would have to make up that revenue from some other source. It would most likely be the general treasury. And as I pointed out in not only this column but many other articles, there's a real danger to that because it's too easy to cut benefits once you don't really see where the funding comes from, where the funding is sort of buried within the entire federal budget. And I think if they eliminated the payroll tax, which ties benefits so closely to to workers' earnings, then I think you would see Social Security evolve more into a welfare system where it would be means tested. In other words, you would get benefits only if you were below a certain income. And as we know from history, welfare programs are often the first to be cut in a budget crunch because people on welfare, people getting government assistance, have a very faint voice in the corridors of power.
Hmm. Now, what are the reasons that Trump is giving? And it's not just Trump we should point out. I mean, you know, there's been an attack on Social Security and even Medicare, but Social Security since 1935 when it first started. So what are the reasons that they're giving to get rid of the payroll tax?
Well, I think the argument is they think that this can be presented as a middle-class tax cut. Essentially, workers would be led to think that they're getting an immediate 6.2% raise because that's the amount they would no longer see being taken out of their paychecks. Employers would get this benefit, too, and there's an economic assumption that the 6.2% that employers pay actually is the same as workers paying it because they don't get it in salary instead. So it would look like a middle-class tax cut, but again, you would have all of these drawbacks and downsides to it, and sooner or later, workers would lose out because their benefits would be cut.
Michael Hiltzik, in this article, Social Security Payroll Tax is No Way to Give Workers a Break, you point out that, to some degree, Obama set the stage for this move by Trump. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, back in 2010, as part of a deal that President Obama cut with Republicans in Congress, President Obama wanted to extend a low-income benefit program called Making Work Pay that was giving low-income workers a refundable tax credit that would help them make ends meet. And this was, of course, in the immediate aftermath of the Great Recession, in which a lot of jobs were lost and a lot of income was lost, particularly for middle-income and low-income workers. So they had this program which gave a check of, I think, up to $800 to low-income households every year. Obama wanted to extend that. The Republicans in Congress flatly refused. They didn't like Making Work Pay. They wanted to kill it. And the deal that was ultimately cut was for, to some extent, the money that had been going to these working-class households from Making Work Pay would come to them instead through a temporary, it was at first supposed to be a one-year reduction in the workers' share of the payroll tax from 6.4% to 4.4%, so that's 2 percentage points of income that workers would be able to keep rather than having to put into Social Security. And the understanding was very clear, it was in black and white, that 2 percentage points would be made up for that year from the general budget. And you can see that in the books of Social Security, that for that year, and then it was extended for a second year, there's income that came from the federal government to make up for the reduction in payroll tax. And I and many other advocates of Social Security argued at the time that this was a very bad idea because it was the first step in decoupling the revenue stream for Social Security from the benefits, and that the risk was that 2 years later, people would forget that they had made this deal, and then the payroll tax would be restored to its original level, and that would look like a tax increase, and there would be political issues with that. And I think that happened, although they were able to restore it in time. But it was a very bad precedent, as I argued. It worked out okay because the money was made up from the general treasury, and eventually the payroll tax was restored. But I think this idea from Trump and the Republicans to eliminate the payroll tax really is an echo of that earlier step that was so unwise in the first place.
Now, the Republicans, and they're not just the Republicans, Obama did this as well, say that Social Security is unsustainable, it's a Ponzi scheme. I don't understand the logic of actually cutting the funds for it as a way to make it stronger. I wonder if you could give the argument that they're putting out to do this.
Well, I don't understand the argument myself, and I don't agree with it, and I certainly don't agree with the rhetoric. So I can't really explain it. I think basically it's smoke and mirrors, and that the underlying idea here is to cut the revenue base, to eliminate the revenue base for Social Security, to substitute this sort of general revenue base, and then that would make it much, much easier to cut benefits down the line. So I think it's very dangerous. It's a terrible idea. It really puts Social Security at the mercy of short-term politics all the time, and it's really not something you want to do.
And now finally, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have said that far from cutting Social Security, we actually need to increase benefits to Social Security. What is the solution that you would recommend?
I think they're absolutely right. There's a lot of there are very good rationales for expanding Social Security today. For one thing, we know that over the years, certainly in recent decades, we've seen worker pensions reduced materially. Workers who had pension plans from their employers have been moved into 401k defined contribution plans. These are not as strong as pension plans. They place much more risk on the workers instead of their employers. We know for a fact that there are fewer assets, especially among middle-class and working-class households in 401ks, than the values that many households were able to build up in corporate pensions. We know that it's harder and harder for households to save for their retirement, and that means that more and more retirees are entering retirement with fewer resources that are going to help them as they grow older and need money. So the answer, I think, and Senators Warren and Sanders agree, is to make Social Security even better, to increase benefits, to extend benefits to more workers, to improve them and raise them, to make up for the loss in retirement resources we've seen across the board in the United States.
And how can we pay for that?
Well, we can pay for it, first of all, by removing the income cap on the payroll tax. As you may know, the payroll tax today is this 6.2% or the 12.4% at both ends tax on wage income, and that's wage income up to a certain level. This year, it's $127,000. But that leaves a lot of wage income untaxed and unavailable to help fund Social Security. If we removed that cap or raised it substantially, we would have much more money for Social Security to fund these things. So I think that's probably the number one choice that we have, is to increase the tax or at least extend it to more and more people, wealthy people, who are not paying their fair share.
Well, Michael Hiltzik, your article for the LA Times, your op-ed is Social Security Payroll Taxes, No Way to Give Workers a Break, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Go to writersvoice.net for a link to Hiltzik's piece for the LA Times. One of Hiltzik's sources for his column on Trump's attack on the payroll tax was Nancy Altman of Social Security Works. She wrote a recent piece for the Huffington Post entitled, Five Ways Donald Trump Has Broken His Promise to Protect Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid in His First 100 Days. We've spoken to her before about the Republican attack on Medicare and Medicaid. We called her up this week to ask her about how Trump has joined that assault. Nancy Altman, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, you are the president of Social Security Works, and we've spoken to you before about Medicare. These two programs, Social Security and Medicare, are closely aligned. And as you point out in your article, when Donald Trump ran for president, he promised to protect Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. In fact, he made that promise a centerpiece of his general election campaign. Did you have any reason then to believe that he was telling the truth with that promise?
In fact, I had concerns about what he was saying because he had a history before running for president where he clearly opposed Social Security. He called it a Ponzi scheme, which of course is a ridiculous slander of the program. And he talked about privatization was good for all of us, and so forth. He had really a history of not being an opponent, but he also had made clear he understood the politics of Social Security. It was in 2011 he was on Sean Hannity's show and said, Republicans can't just go out on their own to cut Social Security because they'll lose elections. So it's clear he understood the politics of it, and the question was whether he'd had a change of heart. But there was reason to believe that he was simply saying what he knew was popular.
Well, it's been 100 days and some change since his inauguration. You write it's not looking good for him to actually fulfill that promise he made, just as you suspected. And you list several reasons why. The first is about the healthcare side of it. Talk about what the plans are, what his proposals are around Medicare and Medicaid.
Absolutely. Because the promise extended to all three programs, that he would protect all three of them. Even before he was inaugurated, right after the election, Speaker of the House Paul Ryan said that he was going to go after Medicare and he was going to voucherize or so-called or privatize Medicare within the first year. Sure enough, as part of the proposal to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, something I call Trump Care, Trump Care raids Medicare. It takes $118 billion of its dedicated revenue away, which would create revenue problems for the program. Nobody even is talking about that, but that's a serious cut to the program that he is, as we speak, are pushing hard to have that proposal turned into law. He also, even more seriously, drastically changes Medicaid so that it would no longer be the guaranteed protection that it is. So in his proposal, which he is actively working for, he's pressuring Congress to enact it, is an attack on Medicare and Medicaid in direct opposition to his campaign promise.
You say in your article also that there have been other Republicans who have suggested not just raiding Medicare, Social Security, and Medicaid, but then using that money to give themselves big tax cuts.
Yes, and that really is the story behind Trump Care. It doesn't provide health care for anyone. It takes health care away from 24 million people and provides huge tax cuts for those at the very top. But I make a distinction between the tax cuts and the dedicated revenue. Social Security has dedicated revenue, and so does Medicare. And what this proposal does is take away that dedicated revenue, which keeps it from contributing. Because Social Security has its own dedicated revenue and has no borrowing authority, it doesn't contribute at all to the deficit. Medicare, part of it is funded through general revenue, but part of it, the hospital insurance piece, is funded through dedicated revenue, just the way Social Security is, and his plan would take that away. So this is really a direct assault on Medicare and Medicaid. He's had other direct assaults on Social Security, and all of these are completely in opposition to his campaign promise not to hurt these programs.
Now, can he even do this? I mean, isn't there any kind of protection under the law that this not to raid these funds?
Well, he's trying to change the law. So he cannot do it on his own, and that's the good news. He can't take the funding away. But this is a buried provision within this, you know, all of the discussion is repealing and replacing Obamacare. No one is talking about the fact that it is a direct assault on Medicare. There was plenty of campaign talk about the Affordable Care Act, but no one voted to destroy Medicare.
Now, let's talk about the American Health Care Act. You say it would also not only be destructive to Medicare, but also to Medicaid. Talk about how this doesn't just affect seniors.
Yes, it is very, very destructive of Medicaid. It would really dismantle Medicaid. The idea is to block grant it to the states. First of all, they take a huge amount, almost $1 trillion, out of it, and then they talk about block granting it to the states, or it's not exactly a block grant, but it's similar to that, where over time they would just really just ratchet it down where it would no longer provide medical insurance. That's the reason that CBO, one of the main reasons CBO found that Trump Care would cause 24 million Americans to lose their health insurance. If the Trump Care really affects seniors, it undermines Medicare. Medicaid is extremely important to seniors because it's the main source of nursing home financial insurance for nursing homes. And it also imposes an age tax on seniors that the AARP has talked about, and it would cause someone, the CBO used an example of a 64-year-old with income of $26,000 who currently pays $1,700, just kind of hanging on till Medicare, would pay $1,700 under the Affordable Care Act. Under Trump Care, that individual would wind up paying more than half of his or her income, over $14,000, just in insurance premiums, not to mention copays and deductibles and all the other costs.
Now, these attacks would also affect people with disabilities, right? Talk about what...
Very much. Yeah. All of these programs are extremely important for seniors and, as you say, for people with disabilities. None of us like to think about becoming disabled, but actually it is, unfortunately, all too common. So that, you know, this is something that can affect any of us. And Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid are the most important programs for people with disabilities, providing cash benefits and paying for providing them with health insurance. And again, these are direct attacks on those programs. Also, low-income children are very much affected. Social Security is the nation's largest children's program, and most of those children are of low income. They're children whose parents have become disabled or have died prematurely. And Medicaid is insurance for those of low income. So many people in that program are children.
Now, another way you say that Trump is betraying his promise to the American people during the campaign to protect Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid is by appointing basically a wrecking crew in his cabinet, appointing people who are the foxes in the hen house, who are there actually to kill the agencies. Talk about Mulvaney and Tom Price.
Absolutely, and let's not also forget, even before President Trump was inaugurated, he had named as his vice president a man, Mike Pence, who not only supported privatizing Social Security, but criticized former President Bush for not privatizing it fast enough and not going far enough. So these are people, he has surrounded himself with people who are anti-Social Security. Tom Price has talked about wanting to end Medicare. He is now in charge of Medicare, and in fact, he is a trustee because of his position as Secretary of Health and Human Services. Health and Human Services is one of very few people who are trustee of Social Security and Medicare. Trustees are supposed to be acting in our behalf, but he is hostile to both these programs. Same is true of Mick Mulvaney, who is the OMB director. He has direct control over how much the administration seeks in funding to administer Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. He's been all over television talking about how he's trying to convince Donald Trump to just go back on his campaign promise about protecting these programs, and indeed has been trying to find ways for Trump to weasel out of these promises. He talked about nobody thinks disability insurance is part of Social Security. Well, the 11 million people, working families who've suffered serious and work-ending disabilities, sure know Social Security is part of it, as do the rest of us. All of us have protection. We are earning those benefits. We've paid for those benefits. And the idea that he can divide and conquer is just wrong, but it just shows that Donald Trump, despite saying he was going to protect these programs, has surrounded himself with people who are egging him on to renege on his promise.
So, Nancy Altman, where can people go to find about this assault on longstanding programs, not only by Trump, but also by the Republicans in Congress?
My organization, Social Security Works, is following this very closely, and our website, socialsecurityworks.org, is a place where people can get up-to-the-minute information about what's going on. If they want to sign up, we send out regularly information about what is happening, steps we urge people to take, and so forth. So it is one way to get information is to go to socialsecurityworks.org.
Well, Nancy Altman, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice. You are the president of Social Security Works, and we will be sure to link to both your posts about that as well as to the organization.
Thank you so much.
Nancy Altman is the president of the advocacy group Social Security Works. Go to writersvoice.net for links to Social Security Works as well as to Nancy Altman's piece, 5 Ways Donald Trump Has Broken His Promise to Protect Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid in His First 100 Days. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.